All right, it's 9 a.m. Everybody excited and ready to talk about regulatory compliance? Now, I know you wouldn't be here. I know it. I know you would not be here if this wasn't a nightmare for you. Because you don't typically go to a session on regulatory compliance unless this is something that you're actually facing and dealing with. So the trouble with that is that sometimes I get folks in a room like this that all they want to do is actually tell everyone about their personal nightmare and vent about it. And you know what? We will have some time toward the end for that, so not to worry. If you're here really because you think this is sort of like a session where we can all kind of give a group hug on the dilemma, we have microphones in the middle. You're welcome to take the center stage there and tell us what you're dealing with. It's my hope that by the end of the discussion, we alleviate some of the frustration. And I think a big key to that is honesty. And I think that sometimes you might find that with some of the sessions you've attended here, that not that things are not necessarily honest, but they're slanted a certain way. And that's because they have to be. Obviously, if you're hearing a session from a Microsoft employee, it has to be slanted a certain way. Whereas when you're hearing from a third party, from an external Exchange MVP, the discussion can be a bit more honest, a little bit more open. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. Maybe you've never heard of me before. My name is J. Peter Brazzisi, and I'm an Exchange MVP, as I mentioned. I've been received the award 4 times in a row, so that's nice. I'm a Microsoft Certified Trainer. I have a variety of different certifications, a lot of acronyms. I'm co-founder and CIO of a company called Clip Training, which is a provider of Windows and Office task-based videos. I'm a technical author with over a dozen books that have been sold internationally. Technical speaker for Tech Mentor Connections, more recently MEC, the last 2 MECs here, Tech Ed. I'm a product reviewer for MSExchange.org, been doing that for roughly 5 years. I'm a journalist for InfoWorld. I write the Enterprise Windows column, been doing that for over 5 years as well. And I'm an instructor for Pluralsight on all of their Exchange 2010 and 2013 courses. In fact, we have a representative from Pluralsight here giving away 30-day free trials to the Pluralsight portal. So you can watch any of the Exchange training that's there on, we just released a course on regulatory compliance, actually. So Brent is right here, down here in the front. Wave your hand so everybody can see you. If you'd like 30 free days of that, by all means, see Brent. So, you know, I would tell you what I do in my spare time, but it's pretty obvious with all of this that I have no spare time. This is all that I do. And that's why I'm here speaking with you today, because when you're focused to such a great degree on one thing, you see things over time. Some things, you know, didn't bother me until recently. For the last 5 or 6 years, I was focused on unified messaging. I thought that was cool. High availability, I thought, wow, what a great feature. But it was just in the last year that somebody actually shone the spotlight on regulatory compliance and the problems that folks are having with it. And I thought, well, gee, how hard could it be? I mean, you know, what's the real issue? And then I started to get into it. And as I could see on some of your pained faces, you know, you have a permanently etched stress line in your face because of regulatory compliance and your organization. So let's just hit the agenda first for this discussion. We're going to review the purpose of regulatory compliance and the fear that it causes, along with some creative thoughts on how to mitigate that fear. That's not necessarily, I'm not going to actually promote some of these thoughts, but they are creative, and we're going to go through some of those. We're going to discuss the built-in tools that Exchange has and how they can help administrators with compliance. But again, I think that we need to do this from the perspective of being honest about what the tools can and cannot do. I call them gaps. I say that the tools have gaps in them because no tool is perfect, right? We know that. We get that. So we're going to discuss some of these gaps. Then we're going to discuss a few third-party options that can assist in helping you meet regulatory compliance needs. And I'm going to open it up to the floor for any other third-party tools that you think would benefit the audience. Because obviously that's the nice thing about being a group here of experts and peers, is that we can share the things that have worked in our own environments. So just to get started here, this is a quote from Robert Mueller. He said, "The collapse of Enron was devastating to tens of thousands of people, and it shook the public's confidence in corporate America." Right? Enron is just one of the dilemmas that has caused this regulatory compliance nightmare that we face today. All around the globe, we see governments instituting more and more regulations. The idea is to provide for greater operational transparency. That's the whole point, right? Transparency. What that actually translates to you is that you actually have to be able to provide that transparency for your organization. And that can be frustrating. There are standards that are enforced across the board in different countries, and some of you are from, you know, some of you have traveled a great distance to be here, and in your country you might have different regulations than what we would face in the U.S. or in other places, but we're all facing the same problem, which is how to meet the regulatory compliance needs and do it in a way so that it's not overwhelming to us, not overly stressful. So what is regulatory compliance? For those who are not fully aware, it's basically the adherence to laws, guidelines, or specifications by an organization. Now, who provides those guidelines? Well, in some cases, those guidelines might be provided by the government. In other cases, you might be dealing with corporate policy, which typically follows the governmental policies that have been put into place. So failure to comply is often met with some form of punishment if discovered. I haven't heard of anybody going to jail yet, but there are certainly fines that have been imposed. So perhaps at this point you're feeling like this, right? You're feeling like when you're sitting with the folks from HR or you're talking with your legal team, you're thinking, you know what, I'm just going to end up in jail. This is where it's all going to go. But it doesn't have to be that way. Typically, what you see when you're looking at all the different regulations, you see things like Sarbanes-Oxley. You see the HIPAA law, the Patriot Act, and all of these different regulatory compliance laws. We're not going to go through those. That's not what this session is about. It's just to make you aware that there are a great number of different regulations that you have to be aware of. If you're in a smaller organization, that can be difficult. Larger ones typically have folks to help with that. Their legal representatives will take care of that. So you would think then that in larger organizations, you would not have the nightmare that perhaps smaller organizations have because they have all this help and they can hire more help. But I don't know if you've seen these, but in large organizations, like recently, a couple years back, Citigroup fined $750,000 for losing millions of emails. You see all of these different ones. LPL fined $9 million for email failures. Right? These are very large organizations that have very, unfortunately, large fines now imposed against them because of a lack of following regulatory compliance. So this is something that is now a burden for you. And it's something that we need to get through. So in larger organizations, sometimes there's a legal team. How many of you have an organization where you have a legal team to assist with this? Right? Okay, good. And how many of you have, in smaller businesses, how many of you are just pretty much on your own? Good, all right, so that's good. So not too many are on your own. You know, it's interesting, smaller businesses, to assist with the problem of not having all of the resources of a larger organization, the government set up a site called business.usa.gov. that provides small businesses with resources on how to accomplish the task of being compliant. So here's what's kind of happened. So folks have said, I want to be compliant, but you know what, this is just too much of a hassle. And in some organizations, it's not even a necessity, whether it's healthcare or, if you're in healthcare, it's a necessity. But if you're in a different type of business, maybe your legal team has told you, you know what, we don't really need to be compliant at all. So here's where the creativity has come into play. I thought that regulatory compliance was just something that you just did. You do as you're told, right? If the government says you should have all of this data, then you should have all of this data. But what's interesting is last year I was at TechEd, and I was sitting at dinner with some folks that I'm not really supposed to tell you the company name, but let's just say that they are a large media organization, and they send out about 1 billion emails a year. And I'm sitting there, and I'm talking, I'm asking them questions about regulatory compliance, and one of them says, oh yeah, we don't retain data. And I said, what do you mean? I didn't know that that was an option. They said, oh yeah, no, because we're not in one of those like healthcare or government type organizations, we actually have a deletion policy, not a retention policy. And their thing is they save it for 45-day inbox retention with a 15-day backup retention. Any of you started doing this? All right, over there, I was talking to some guys over here, that's what they're doing. Right? Instead of worrying about regulatory compliance, if you have a circumstance where you can actually avoid retention, that seems a whole lot easier, right? The idea is they cannot discover what we don't have. Now, you might say, well, so this is great. This is what Jay Peter wants to talk to us about is this alternative thinking. But here's the problem. There's a flaw in this thinking. And I had an opportunity to talk to a good friend of mine, Julian Martin. And I said, Jules, what is the flaw to this thinking? It sounds great. Just no retention if you can avoid it. And he pointed out, he said, Peter, remember, there's two sides to every email conversation. There's the sender and there's the receiver. So just because you've eliminated one side of the conversation, that doesn't mean you've eliminated the other. And so if you do that, if you decide, you know what, we're not going to retain email because we don't want to and we don't have to legally, you put yourself at a greater risk when it comes time for litigation. Because the other side, your enemy, so to speak, has the emails. They know what they have, but you don't, because you've eliminated your ability to discover even your own company's dilemma here. So I think that there are advantages, obviously, you know, the upfront advantage, less stress being a key, but in a world of excessive litigation, which is what we see today, it may be better to know as much as the prosecution does, right? So I'm not saying that this is the best solution. So what is the best solution? Well, that's where we start talking about built-in tools to assist in exchange regulatory compliance. Am I saying this is the best solution? No. No, these tools, it's important that we actually talk honestly about what these tools can and can't do. Because some folks are only using the built-in tools that Exchange comes with. And in some cases, that's perfectly fine. That's all you possibly need. In other cases, they're perhaps misled into thinking that this will provide a full range of regulatory compliance when it doesn't. So let's just talk about some of these tools. For starters, in-place archive. How many of you went to some regulatory compliance sessions yesterday? Right, there was a couple, we went to? Yeah, I was in a few of them too. You know, I kept hearing the word immutability. How many of you heard that word, immutability? Right? I'm not going to ask you how many of you know what it means. Because I saw it all over slides, I've seen it before, and I thought, you know, it's funny because it's a really big word for a very, you know, simple definition. It means making sure that something is not susceptible to change, right? So if you are retaining data, if you're retaining emails, and the end user has the ability to alter that process, has the ability to change the content, well, then you don't have a situation where you can really be compliant, right? So immutability is the driving force behind a lot of these tools that we see here. The idea that with compliance features, we need to be able to retain data in an unchangeable form. And so as a result of that concept, they created Dumpster 2.0, which is really our recoverable items folders. And they started working on things like litigation hold. This was all with Exchange 2010. And now we see that with Exchange 2013, that they've actually enhanced all of these features. So we have things like in-place archive, in-place hold, in-place e-discovery. And I have an Office 365 portal up as well. We can throw that up there if we have some time and kind of look through some of these tools. My hope was to just discuss things from a conceptual perspective at this point, because I'm not sure exactly where everyone in the audience is with these tools. But let's just talk about, you know, this whole in-place archive, hold, and e-discovery. First of all, why is it called in-place? You know, that seems like an odd term, in-place. But the point of that was to sort of give you the indication that it's basically handled in-house, as opposed to giving it off to a third party, right? In place, in-house, archive, right? So as they said yesterday, their whole focus here seems to be driving towards built-in, not bolt-on. Unfortunately, you know, in order to do that, you have to give us tools that are going to meet our needs. So we look at in-place archive. What is in-place archive? Ultimately, it's a secondary mailbox, right? Secondary mailbox, it is a place to move PST files to, right? That's the whole point. We have a problem. It wasn't always a problem, right? PST files weren't always a problem. In fact, years back, they were a solution. We had, you know, mailboxes where we were really tight with space because storage was expensive. And so end users complained that we imposed quotas on their mailboxes. Well, with the ability to have a PST file on their desktop, this solved the problem, right? We had no problem with PSTs, because we weren't so concerned about data being discoverable. If they were willing to move their junk to their own desktop and something happened, so be it. But ultimately, we retained our quotas and our storage space was kept small. So then things changed. You know, with Enron, with the various sexual harassment type cases that have come up, with various business corporate espionage that's come up, all of these regulations come into play, and all of a sudden, PSTs are a bad thing. They're a nightmare. I've given sessions on eliminating the PST nightmare, just because now that's a nightmare. And so all the in-place archive is really meant to do is give you the ability to get folks to move those PSTs to this secondary mailbox, which you can put on cheaper disk. You know, some are still stuck on the whole, we need our high-performance SAN that we bought 10 years ago for $50,000 to be running our mailboxes, and then we can have this secondary mailbox, this archive mailbox, PST holder, as I like to call it, and that can be on the cheapest disk possible. I say that they're still stuck on that because, you know, I think it's more of a financial issue. They bought this box, they still need to show that they're using it. But with current Exchange, especially since they removed single instance storage, you know, the performance is really incredible. You can use JBOD arrays and go with cheap disk for your mailboxes. We can debate that another time. I know some of you are like, no, you can't. We must stick with the high performance SAN. So we have this in-place archive, PST, you know, mover. Now, does that help with compliance? It absolutely does. I'm not going to say to you that doesn't help with compliance. Anytime you can take data off the desktop and put it somewhere where it's in a single location that can be discoverable, that's a smart move. So I like the in-place archive. I just think it's poorly named. I don't think it should be called in-place archive. I know you're thinking, can he say that? Can he really say that? Yes, I've said it directly to Microsoft. You know, they have MVPs come up to the summit, and we get a chance to talk to the product team, and there's pretty open dialogue. And I've said, listen, this is the wrong term. You know, first of all, I don't like in place because there's really no reason for that. And then the word archive. When I think of an archive, I think of something that's read-only, untouchable. You know, or if it's at least touchable or viewable by the end user, you know, they can see it, but they can't necessarily make any changes. But here's the funny thing about the in-place archive. Out of the box, just like with a regular mailbox, the end user has control over deleting items. So when things go in the in-place archive, it's really just a secondary mailbox, not a big deal. The end user can delete stuff. How can it be discoverable if the end user deletes it? See, so while it solves one problem of regulatory compliance, the fact that you're getting your data all in one spot, it doesn't solve the other problems, which is your end users still have control to get rid of it. So what does Microsoft say? Well, say, well, that's because we have another feature that you're going to love, right? In-place hold, right? Or there's also legal or litigation hold. How many of you in your organizations put every mailbox on legal hold? From day one. That guy. Okay. You might say, wow, that's a problem, because, I mean, if I did that, that would create huge storage bloat. Good thing storage cheap, right? You can do that. Is that really the best option? So what exactly is the difference between legal hold and in-place hold? Let's talk about that for a second. So you have legal hold, which you can put a mailbox, the entire mailbox on legal hold, everything. Every email that's sent, received, it's on hold. When you do that, the end user is not made aware of it, unless you make them aware of it, unless you tell them, they're not made aware of it. A lot of folks don't like doing this because what you're basically doing is you're bloating out the mailboxes because now everything's going to be retained. But you say, look, this is the best way to get discoverability of everything. This way, if the end user wants to delete stuff, I can still discover it. Okay, it's an option. It is an option. In fact, in Office 365, if you ask them to turn on their archive feature, if you pay for it, I think it's like $3, you know, per user, per month kind of thing. Well, all they really do is they just turn on legal hold on the mailbox, and it just pretty much, you know, holds everything in the recoverable items folders. In-place hold is different. Now, with 2010, we just had legal hold. You could grab the whole thing. With in-place hold, you pretty much have the ability to narrow it down. So let's say there's a sexual harassment case between, two people in the organization, and the one person sent all these horrible emails, and so now you come in and you're going to say, listen, we don't need to hold everything that this person has sent, but we want to make sure that all emails between, you know, person A and person B are retained. You can do that. That's what in-place hold is all about. So it gives you a little bit more of a granular control there. I'm going to tell you in a minute where there's a gap in that thinking, but at least it's available. The reason for this is so that now you can focus in on what you're going to hold without having to stress about the bloat that comes from putting the whole mailbox on hold. Then you have in-place e-discovery. How many of you have used, with Exchange 2010, you used multi-mailbox search? Right? Horrible, horrible tool. Right? Horrible features there. I can say that. It's okay. I'm not going to get in trouble. I think I'm not going to get in trouble. I don't know. Maybe I am going to get in trouble. If you don't see me on the roster next year, now you know why. But they knew that. They knew that it was a horrible tool because that's why they advanced it. And I think that the e-discovery in Exchange 2013 is really much, much more robust and much better. Still not perfect, but really, really good compared to what we had. Then you have things like messaging records management. right, MRM. And we've seen the progression of this between Exchange 2007, 2010, and now 2013. To me, this is more of a cleanup type tool, a way to get end users to clean up all the clutter in their inbox. There's journaling, which gives us the ability to pretty much capture all email going in and out of the company, or on a more granular level, if you have premium journaling, you can zero in on specific individuals and capture email that way, send it off to a journal mailbox. We have transport rules. Personally, I think transport rules are one of the best features we've ever seen in Exchange. I think they're underutilized because I think it's a matter of creativity, right? So if I say transport rules, I'm sure many of you, the first thing you think of is disclaimer, right? Because that you know, I could put a transport rule together, and that's the first thing you do when you set up an Exchange server. You create the disclaimer. Great, okay. But after that, you kind of go, what else am I supposed to do with this thing? And you don't know. I think it would be really cool to have a session on the best type of transport rules that you can create, just to give you a little creative boost there in how you might use transport rules in your organization, other than for the disclaimer. I think data loss prevention is a good step in that direction already, because with DLP, and I think you've seen a lot of presentations on DLP already, with DLP, you have the ability to now use transport rules to prevent end users from doing things that might not necessarily be wise, like sending social security numbers across to other individuals, or credit card information or banking information. And you can use DLP to give them some kind of a warning in the policy tip, or to just pretty much tell them this isn't going to happen. So you can use it to educate end users, and I like that feature. Then you have mailbox and administrator audit logging, which is a nightmare to set up. And you have information rights management. How many of you are running information rights management in-house? I just want to thank you. He's raised his hand for pretty much every question I've asked, and I love that. Thank you. He's a financial services organization. There you go. So that's why you're here, because this is a nightmare, and he's hoping that I eliminate the nightmare by the end of the thing. We're going to get you a new job. If anyone's looking for a really great guy, he's right here. How's that for eliminating your nightmare? So we've talked about all these different tools. Maybe you're using some of them, maybe you aren't. Let's talk about the gaps. Right? I've already talked about some of the gaps when it comes to the in-place archive. It's a great tool for getting the PSTs off of your desktop systems. But it is not, and I repeat, it is not an archive solution. When you think of an archive, the in-place archive is a secondary mailbox. It's not an archive. Okay? They know that. Microsoft knows this. And down the line, they say, give us a few months. We're going to have something new to present, at least in the Office 365 side to things, because who knows when it's going to come down to the on-premise Exchange. In-place hold. One of the problems with hold or legal hold is, when do you typically put a mailbox on legal hold? I asked the audience here, who has, how many of you have everyone on legal hold? And a lot of you don't. Well, why? Because that's just going to create bloat. So what do? You wait for the order to come through that you're going to put a mailbox on legal hold. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm the person who's sending inappropriate emails, I'm not going to wait for this order to come through for legal hold before I start deleting my stuff, right? So a lot of this stuff is already gone, and that's kind of the thing. Legal hold, it's after the fact, typically, after the problem is reported. In fact, in one organization, this is a frustrating story. In one organization, a woman was being sexually harassed by her boss, and emails were being sent to her. She didn't print out the emails. She didn't retain them in any way. She had no control over the mailbox there. And what ended up happening is she just got so upset and frustrated that she quit and she left. It was months and months later when someone said to her, you really should bring a case here. This was inappropriate, and you should bring a case against your boss. So she did. But in this situation, the mailbox and both mailboxes were on the same system. So it wasn't like these were emails being sent to a separate email system. They're all in the same system. Her mailbox was gone by this point. There was no proof of any kind of retention on either side. She had no proof of these emails. And he had certainly deleted any email trail on his part. So it ended up being he said, she said kind of thing. And that's frustrating. Now, that's not discoverable. If you can't, if none of this is discoverable, then how does that help people to avoid this type of actions within the workplace? I think a mind shift is necessary. Instead of looking at regulatory compliance as being just a complete nightmare, which it is, but it's also a way to ensure that things are being done properly within organizations. And you have that opportunity to be that person, that line for your organization. And maybe it's not what you signed up for, but with the types of problems that companies are having these days, it's part of the burden that you bear. So in-place hold is not necessarily going to help you with that burden if you turn it on after the legal case has already been pulled together. The nice thing about in-place hold as opposed to legal hold is that you do have the ability to avoid the single instance storage bloat. The fact that, you know, you turn it on and now the mailbox just bloats out. Although, again, storage is getting cheaper and cheaper. We talked about in-place e-discovery as far as it being an improvement. Messaging records management. We talked about how it really relies heavily, in most cases, on end-user participation. How many of you are using some type of MRM for your environment? These guys over here. You know, basically, it allows for a cleaner, leaner mailbox, right? Because you can set up rules that say, past a certain point, we want these emails deleted. Past a certain point, we want them archived and deleted. You know, you could set up all sorts of different rules. The only negative to that is that for every rule that you set up, you have to manage those rules. You have to be aware that they're in existence. In some cases, a lot of folks are using the retention tags. They're creating personal retention tags, which puts the onus back on the end user to actually tag their emails for archive or tag them for deletion and so forth. And so, again, you have these great tools, but if the end users aren't using them, then what good are they? Journaling is easy to tamper with. You know, we talk about journaling. We say it's great. You have the ability to get a copy of emails in this sense. But the problem with straight journaling is that even Microsoft, when you look up at TechNet, if you look on TechNet where it says journaling, it makes the point that this is not an archive solution and that it is not necessarily going to provide for full regulatory compliance. So you might say, well then what's journaling good for? You know, journaling is good for a lot of things. In fact, a lot of third-party archive solutions, you know, will look at journaling, and they'll use that in order to get the email into another location. But one thing that journaling is good for is, let's say if you have some type of regulation that says you need to review employee-client communications as part of your corporate or legal policies. So every 3 months or so, you have to be able to prove that you went through a certain amount of emails and you were able to see that the communication was appropriate. In the financial sector, that might be a big thing, I don't know. But being able to prove that and being able to access it easily, journaling is a good way to do that. That's one of the things that Microsoft touts on TechNet as well, that you can use journaling to accomplish that goal. Transport rules. We've talked a little bit about it already as far as DLP and the enhancements that have now come with Service Pack 1. Things like the document fingerprinting. Did you see some of that yesterday in the keynote? I thought that was fantastic, really neat. I would have liked to have seen see how it really plays out, so I'll have to just kind of do that at home and test it. Auditing. I mentioned that auditing is complex. The auditing features are incredibly complex in Exchange 2013. It requires the Exchange Management Shell to enable it, and then once you enable it, you then have to determine specific aspects of it. And that can just be a bit overwhelming as well. You know, you wind up having to learn how to code in order to do auditing. I think that's ridiculous. I think they should make that a lot easier in the next version. And then we have information rights management, which we already said some of you, most of you are not even using that. Information rights management is based upon the rights management services, AD rights management services. And the problem with it is when you first read about it and you go, this is fantastic. So you have the ability. If we're all in the same company, let's say, and I'm sending you an email, I can actually say that I don't want this email to be forwarded. I don't want this email to be printed. Right? So I can say all these things, and I can basically use information rights management to enforce that on you. That sounds fantastic. Here's the two problems with it. Problem number one is that when you send an email to someone who is not in your organization, all bets are off. So they can do whatever they want with it. The other problem with it is that if you send me an email and you say, I don't want you to forward this or I don't want you to print this, that's not going to stop me if I really want to do it. Right? Now, for example, one of the things that it can do is it prevents the snipping tool from working. Right? So if I say I don't want you to be able to copy this in any way, or the snipping tool will not take a picture of the email if I wanted to copy it. But it can't prevent a third-party tool from doing it. So if I use a third-party tool, I can get the picture. Or I have this really cool new device, you know, called a cell phone camera, and I can snap a picture of it. There's also a really neat thing called a pen, where I can write down what's in the message. So ultimately, there's ways around this. It's not the best solution for... There's one guy laughing in the back. You know, it's a deterrent, in other words. So, and that's what I meant when I started this, talking about honesty. They need to be honest about what these tools can and can't do. Information rights management is a deterrent. If you've ever tried to set it up, we were actually at the summit in a large room of people, and somebody actually asked, how many of you have set up information rights management with, you know, RMS, set it up in-house? One person raised their hand, and we applauded that person. Because if you've ever tried to set this up, it's a bit of a nightmare, too. So you do a lot of effort, you go through a lot of pain to set this up, only to turn around and have it be, you know, very limited in terms of what it can do. It's a deterrent, not necessarily a preventative measure. Okay, so we've talked about the tools, right? We've talked about what's built in, and, you know, we have some time, we can actually go through some of these tools and take a look at them. Actually, you know, let me do this. In order to do that, I have to kind of change... I have to move the screen over your way here. Let's see. You guys can see that? Yeah, very good. All right. So now you can see, but I can't. Unfortunately, it's just the way the screen setup is. But, you know, here you can see... how many of you are working with Office 365, by the way? You know, just Office 365. I'm just curious. Really? So hybrids? A lot of hybrids? On-prem and Office 365? Yeah, okay. Everybody else, you're all on on-premise Exchange. How many of you are running 2013? Really? So everybody else is running 2010? 2010? 2007? So you guys have no regulatory compliance tools, right? Nothing built in. You have to snap on in those cases. You know, because the thing is, there's been a progression here, right? From 2007 to 2010 and now to 2013. So this is pretty much what we have currently. And depending on what your existing needs are, it might be a driving force towards 2013. Because here you can see we have this compliance management option here. They're working on that unified compliance management tool. Did anybody see that yesterday? They threw it up on the screen. Really, to me, I looked and I just said, that's nice. I said, but it's kind of the same thing as what I have right here. It's just the compliance management channel with all the little pieces up here at the top. Instead, they've got it, you know, organized a little differently. But here you see your in-place e-discovery and hold, your auditing. Here's your DLP. So maybe some of you haven't had a chance to play with this yet, but when you go to set up DLP, there's one thing I wanted to show you folks about this. If you click the little plus sign, there's a little triangle next to it that I'm trying to hit. There we go. And you can see you can set up DLP from a template. It's very important that you take note of this, because if we click this and we decide to set it up, on the left-hand side it's going to show me a bunch of different options, you know, different regulations and laws that may be familiar to you. For example, if we scroll down here, you can see different different countries that are represented. Let's see. Just gotta kinda... I'm looking for the Patriot Act. Okay. You see it there? Is that it? There we go. Okay. Sorry, guys. I can't really see sideways. So what's interesting about this is that they have this organized by various regulatory compliance, you know, laws. And we saw that list, Sarbanes-Oxley and all these other ones there, HIPAA. And you can actually pick one. And what's great about that is that you can see it will actually alter the rules based upon the template that you've chosen. Here's the dilemma, you know, because look, a lot of you, this is not maybe what your whole world is focused around. You know, you have a life as opposed to myself. And so... You know, you look and you go, this is great. If I want to be in compliance with the Patriot Act, I just have to select this DLP template, get it moving out there, we're good. I'm compliant. But actually, if you look at the thing on the right-hand side, the whole definition there, it says, somewhere down the line, it says, use of this policy does not ensure compliance with any regulation. Right? Now, if you click any one of these templates, that line is in there for every single template. They're trying to let you know that The naming is just to give you an idea of what it's going to be focused on, not necessarily to tell you that you should use this and then you're good. You've got the Patriot Act locked, okay? So it's important to realize what it's going to do. Well, now you choose this one, and what it's going to do, this one specifically, the U.S. Patriot Act, it says this will detect the presence of information commonly subject to U.S. Patriot Act, including information like credit card numbers or tax identification numbers. You say, that's great. Well, but what if I need banking information? What if I need other things? Well, the cool thing about DLP is here we can just... start out with the regular template. And wait. So let me tell you what's happening while it's actually spinning here, because it looks like it's doing nothing and we're waiting for no reason. But what's really happening is it's in the process of creating a variety of transport rules in the background. And these transport rules, you can then go in and you can make changes as to how they work. And that's really the cool thing and the flexibility of DLP, is that it gives you the ability to use a template like this, or you can create it from scratch if you'd like. But then you can go in, because they're transport rules, you can literally change every aspect of it. Right? So here it is, it came up. And from here you say, great, well, if I wanted to make changes to this, you know, what do I do? You can go in, you can take a look, you can actually, you know, look at the state of the policy. You could change it from enabled to disabled. You can change the mode, whether or not you want it to be used with policies, with policy tips or not. But you can also go over to rules, and these are the rules that are created, actually. And you can actually jump in on any one of these rules, or you can add additional rules right here. All right, so you click the little plus sign, and you can actually create additional parts to this policy. It's very flexible. You know, it's one thing to stand back and to criticize, right? It's easy to criticize. I can tell you that in-place archive, you know, is not really, is badly named and is really just a secondary mailbox so that you get rid of PSTs. I can say that, and we all know it to be true. Easy to criticize. But when something's done right or is in the right direction, it's really important to praise as well. The exchange team is doing a fantastic job of trying to keep up with these things. And this is, I think, a good one of their best examples in terms of being on the ball. That fingerprint, scanning document thing, that was a really neat feature to add in. So we look here and we say, okay, so I can actually go in and I can make changes to these. I can double-click any of these and alter. This is the actual transport rule itself. You can go in and alter the rule, right? That's pretty neat. You can also add additional parts to this so that, let's say, if you did want to include banking information and other pieces, you can add that in as well. And then if we just go down to, I can't really see. I'm just going to click until I see what I'm looking for. There we go. If we go down to mail flow, notice all of these transport rules are now included in our rules section here under mail flow. So again, the DLP side to this is really neat. It actually is built off of the transport rules, which are one of the features that I think is one of the best features we've seen in Exchange over the years. And it works really well. And then, of course, as we mentioned, we go back up here, you know, we have that document fingerprints and some of these other, you know, features, the policy tips and so forth. This is a great feature, something that we should definitely be using for compliance. Retention policies, this is, again, that MRM, messaging records management. You saw some of this yesterday, and you could see here on the right, you know, there's the default policy, and you've got all these other options. You can create additional policies, but again, a lot of these are, a lot of folks, when I'm working with organizations, I see that they're using these as personal tags. When you create it as a personal tag type situation, you're leaving it up to the end user to decide how they're going to, utilize the policy, if they're going to tag an email message or not. And so if you're going to do that, you know, really all you're then trying to do is, you know, kind of be their mother, you know, like, clean up your inbox, you know, like, who wants to be that person? You know, you don't necessarily want to be focused on that all the time. You've got retention tags. Here's all the different tags. And again, as you can see, notice the actual default retention tags are typically personal tags. You know, you can see down this the type here. Most of them are personal tags. So if you want it to be other than that, then you have to actually create tags that are different. And then you get your journal rules over here. So it's nice that they put everything under compliance management, except for the rules themselves. I kind of thought that's a little odd that they have rules here as opposed to putting that under compliance management as well. So this is the built-in stuff, right? This is what we're dealing with in terms of the built-in stuff. Let's talk a little bit about tools that assist us with compliance. For example, we talk about eliminating PSTs. So one of the tools that Microsoft released is PST Capture. Any of you use the PST Capture tool? One person? Two people? Okay. Yeah, it's a free tool, and it helps you to pull the PST files, you know, and put it into your Exchange in Place archive. You might look to third-party tools as well for things of that sort. For example, in some cases, you may want an archive appliance. Or you might want to go with a cloud-based archive solution to provide another layer of insurance and robust end-user options for archive access. You know, the thing I don't like about the archive appliance, I know that a lot of folks, you know, have these appliances already in-house, is that, again, now it's on-premise as opposed to you being in an alternate location. I like the idea of having things separate, if possible. I think about it with my own files and just even in my own home. I like having a way to have my stuff saved to the cloud. In the event of any kind of disaster, I don't have to worry about, you know, grabbing my systems and my disks and running out of the house with it. Let's consider two third-party offerings, and then I'm going to let you actually tell me what you're using in your organizations to assist when it comes to this. The two different solutions I'm going to provide here, let me just be very upfront. I like them both personally. I know the companies well. I don't work for either one of them. But when I was looking at what tools can I help the audience to appreciate in order to improve with their regulatory compliance, these were the two that I came up with that I thought were really nice. One is a governance and auditing tool, or auditing tool. Somebody should have caught that. KnowBe4. KnowBe4 is compliance management. Anybody ever seen KnowBe4? Ever heard of them? It's interesting. This was a guy named Stu Sauerman who started a company that years back. He created Sunburst antivirus. Anybody ever hear of that? Right. They sold out to Viper, and then he settled in and he started working on some really cool stuff with a guy named Kevin Mitnick. Anyone know who Kevin Mitnick is? Some people are nodding. Really, guys? Kevin Mitnick. I mean, he's famous. He's he was a famous hacker. He went to jail, you know. And he's written a lot of books about it, about social engineering, you know, the art of deception. That's actually one of the titles of his books. Well, so what they did was they realized, they did a lot of testing, and they realized that one of the biggest problems with persons getting into companies is not necessarily the technology, but it's the people. You know, they do all sorts of tests where they drop a bunch of USB keys in the parking lot, and, you know, basically end users, they pick them up and they bring them into the company and they plug them in, you know, and now there's viruses being spread through the organization. So it's very easy to trick people, a lot easier than machines. So what these folks did is they started creating a solution with Kevin Mitnick where he actually demonstrates some of these tricks to help end users to kind of smarten them up a bit. And then what they do is they send out an email. There's various templates. They send out these emails where the end users in your organization get the email, and it's like, you know, I'm your bank. You should click this link. You know, and you go, I didn't know I had an account at that bank, but you click the link. Well, and all it does is it reports back to the administrators that, you know, you're an idiot, and so, you know, you basically have to go through the training all over again, and that's kind of the point, is that it forces folks to take the training now because they are the ones still clicking the links. I think it's a great solution. So recently they came to me and they said, you know, we're really seeing a lot when it comes to compliance, but we see a lot of people are using Excel in order to keep track of their, to audit their tracking needs. Maybe some of you are doing that as well. They said, we want to create a tool that will help folks to organize their compliance a little better and keep track of the responsibilities, who has responsibility for what. What are the timetables for doing things and making sure things are being handled properly? And so they're working on this tool. I said, well, that sounds great. They demonstrated it to me, and I thought it was really cool. So that's one thing I'd like to offer your way. You can certainly check that out with KnowBe4. They're not here, but you can certainly look them up. The other is cloud-based archive solutions. The one that I like to promote is Mimecast, and I'll tell you why. Like I said earlier, I don't like the idea that the end user has any ability to access the archive. So in-place archive is not a good name for that. I believe that the archive should be read-only, and I think that was in one of the slides yesterday by one of the presenters. Should the archive be read-only? I believe the archive should be something that if the end users can see it, they can even interact with it, but they can't delete any of that content because it eliminates your ability to provide true discoverability, right? So what I like about Mimecast is they provide a cloud-based platform that allows for a bottomless mailbox. The end users pretty much, they're everything that comes in and out of the organization and goes in between individuals within the organization gets archived. What's cool is that the end user has access to that archive. So through an Outlook plugin, they can actually touch email in the archive. So if they've deleted something that was in their inbox and they go, oh, you know, I deleted it, it's okay. It's still in the archive. They can touch it. They can get that email back. Folks at Mimecast did a little demo for me where they had their phone, and they did a search for an email that was 5 or 6 years old, and it came up like that. I thought that was really impressive. But the best part is that the end users have no control over the archive retention. I also think, and it's sort of a mindset, we were talking yesterday with some folks that are handling regulatory compliance at Microsoft here, and they said, what is your problem with legal hold? And I said, you know, I don't necessarily have a problem with it, but I do believe that it's missing something that I think is very important when it comes to the world of regulatory compliance, and that is the transparency with the end users. If you tell the end users, if you let them know, we are going to archive everything that is sent, and you have no control over being able to delete it, it will cull some of that inappropriate and illegal activity within your organization. That's just smart. You know, instead of having to deal with litigation after the fact, make them aware so that they realize, oh, wait, you know what? If I send this email from my work email address, this is going to be a problem. Now, people that want to do bad things will find other ways to do it, but they don't need to do that through your messaging system, do they? So that's sort of the thing. Again, it's a deterrent. Letting folks know that things are going to be retained is a deterrent. And then having it be where they can actually see it, that's a deterrent as well. So those are the tools that I like. What are some of the tools that you folks have come up with that help you when it comes to eliminating the regulatory compliance nightmare? Say again? Tell me about it. Very cool. Okay. Did you hear that?
Yeah, we've got one. I didn't pick it. Called Smarsh.
Yep. Smarsh. So he says global relay, is it? And Smarsh.
Our okay. Business users love it. So.
Interesting. Oh, good. What else? What else do we have? Yes.
Well, I'm from a company called Wob, and we provide an archiving solution as well.
Very cool. What kind? On-premise, cloud-based?
Both.
Okay. Very good.
And one thing I will mention with the transparency to the user, I like that idea, and the ability to prevent them from deleting. That's how our product is built that way, yet in other countries, they have personal information laws that require our archive to allow them to delete.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's something we can, the admin can turn on or off, so something we had to add as we looked at other geographies.
Various countries.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, it's just basic common sense here. I was talking with Paul Robichaud this morning, right? You guys know Paul? Nobody knows Paul? Oh, one guy knows Paul. He's like, I know Paul. Okay. So, you know, Paul has a couple of boys, you know, growing up there, and we were talking about internet safety and the question of whether or not you put a filter on the front end of your internet to prevent all the bad things that are on the internet from coming into your home, or do you simply turn on logging, right? Because if you simply turn on logging and you say, listen, I'm not going to prevent you from going anywhere. You can do whatever you want, but I'm going to be able to see everywhere that you go. Right? That is a deterrent. That's a pretty strong deterrent, right? And I think the same holds true here, too, that if the end user knows everything that's being sent, you know, and received and all of that, that it's actually going to be discoverable, it might make them think twice before they do something stupid, which will eliminate the frustrations of litigation against your organization. Any of you, I mean, not that maybe you don't want to share this, but any of you going through litigation or have gone through litigation in your organizations as a result of, yeah, well, of course you, yeah. Yeah, we knew you were going to raise your hand. No, it's frustrating. Other tools, what else do we have out there?
Shoot. We have a lot of ITAR no form compliance issues where we can't really go to the cloud in a lot of situations. I'm kind of looking for a solution that would honor the ITAR no form commitment in the cloud without having to have 40,000 seats to
do it. Okay. Well, I got some vendors in the room. Anybody do that? ITAR, I'll reiterate it just in case you didn't hear it. ITAR and...
And no porn.
No porn?
No porn.
That too.
No porn. in the cloud, yeah. As opposed to
basically
on-premise.
No U.S., they can't leave the United States, and then no U.S., non-U.S. citizens can access, have any kind of access to the data, even if it means just loading tapes.
Good deal. Well, like I said, there's vendors in the room. See this guy up front, you know, and perhaps they'll get that worked out for you. Yes. Huh. That's okay. That's funny. Other thoughts? Say again. EMC Source One? I can't hear you so good. I'm sorry.
EMC Source One.
Source One, on-prem. Okay. Very good. What else?
Symantec Enterprise Vault.
Enterprise Vault, Symantec, okay. Yeah, it's funny, a lot of, when we talk about compliance, right, everything seems to boil down to archive, right? I mean, it seems to boil down to retention of data so that it's discoverable. As you can see, the built-in tools that Microsoft provides go a lot, you know, they actually miss that part, right? That's the part that they need to work on is the archive piece. I'm kind of glad that they don't have that locked in because it allows, you know, many of you folks who are vendors in the room here to work on something. And I always think that that's good. I don't necessarily like the whole idea of built-in, not bolt-on, because what they're saying is that, you know, we're going to do everything and sort of eliminate our third-party friends here. I don't think that's their intent. I think their intent is to, from what I saw yesterday with a couple of the charts as far as what they're looking to build out, I think they're looking to just provide a greater level of control through Exchange than what they currently have, not necessarily eliminate any others from playing in that space. But I think it's nice to see that whereas that's not, they don't have a strong suit there in terms of archive, look at all the other tools that they have provided, like DLP and some of these other tools that we talked about. If you're not taking advantage of them, now maybe take another look at them, reconsider whether or not they can help you in your environment to provide a greater level of compliance. So good, I'm glad everybody had an opportunity to show up this morning. I know it's tough, when it's a 9 o'clock session, you know, it's tough to even just, you know, get here after a night like last night. Hopefully everybody had a nice time at in all the various clubs there. Let me just give you some contact information for me. So if you want to get in touch with me, jpb@cliptraining.com. My Twitter is @jpbrazizi. You can read my InfoWorld blog, which if you just go to infoworld.com, you'll find it. But one thing I wanted to mention is that my latest book, I had two books that just came out. One is down there on the floor in the store space, Mastering Exchange 2013. It's about a 1,000-page book. I don't know that anybody really wants to lug that home, right? But I have a real small book, a fun one, called Conversational Exchange in 10 Days, and had a chance to put this together. It's really a great book for Exchange newbies, mostly focused on really just the whole story of Exchange from beginning to end. We're giving them away at the Mimecast booth at 11:30, from 11:30 to 1:30. I'm going to do a book signing down there. Everyone's welcome to come and get their copy of the book. And then afterwards, we'll be giving it away online in PDF form, you know, just so that we want everyone to be able to have a chance to read it. It's just fun. It's got cartoons. It's easy for folks to read. If you have people in if you have PR, marketing, sales, you know, folks that need to learn Exchange quickly, this is a great way to do it. I had the assistance of Teresa Miller. She's down here in the front. Wave, Teresa. She's my lead technical editor, and a lot of other MVPs participated in this. You know, one of the things about the MVP community is that, you know, our whole focus and goal is to help you to learn as much about Exchange as possible. And it's the fact that we can be transparent, the fact that we can be honest. If any of you seen or read Tony Redmond's stuff, right, there's a guy who's very honest. You know, so we have the ability to be a little bit more transparent on things, and this is one of those opportunities by giving away a book like this to continue to share the knowledge about Exchange. So by all means, come down there and see that. Fill out evaluations on my mech. You can win prizes and so forth. And so this is pretty much going to conclude the session, give you a little extra time to grab a cup of coffee and move on to whatever you're about to see next. A good friend of mine named Mark Manassi says at the end of all of his sessions, he says, remember to use this knowledge for good and not for evil. So thank you very much, folks.